Please be seated. This morning, calling Marilyn Casanova versus Michael Polsky. This is 19 AP 1728 and 23. Could I please have your appearances? No, that is not a problem. So we'll reverse that order. This is why we do this ahead of time. Most of the time it's sort of just already a done deal, but occasionally it makes a difference. So no problem. We can reverse that. So Mr. Becker will go first. Mr. Devine, second. All right, and then back on rebuttal will be Catherine Stadler for 5 minutes. And starting out, it's 15 and 10, right? Okay, perfect. Well, with that, let's proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Ziegler and Justices of the Court. As I stated, my name is Catherine Stadler of Godfrey & Kahn. I'm appearing on behalf of the Bank of New York Mellon N.A. as trustee. This court should reverse the Court of Appeals and reinstate the trial court order for two primary reasons. First, a properly recorded bank mortgage lien in Wisconsin primes all other liens regardless of when they attach, except for taxes and special assessments. Section 706.11 of the Wisconsin statutes mandates this result. Even if the residents had a lien of some kind, they don't, the recorded bank mortgage would have priority over such lien by operation of this statute. The respondents have not even attempted to explain away the operation of 706.11. The arguments you will hear from them are striking in what they do not say. We will not hear an assertion that the transaction documents are faulty or that the mortgage lien is invalid. We will not hear an assertion that the security interest was not properly recorded or perfected. The respondents, in fact, have conceded, as they must, the validity of the trustee's mortgage and security interest. There is no argument against the sale confirmation order from which they appealed, and there is no contention that the Atrium real estate was marketed inadequately, sold to an unsuitable buyer, or at an improper price. The only argument you will hear is that, notwithstanding all of those knots, the things that are missing from the respondent's arguments, somehow an inchoate security interest benefiting the residents arose by way of a very selective reading of the transaction documents. That is not how security interests in real property work. To convey an interest in real property and a security interest represented by a lien is an interest in real property. A conveyance must identify the grantor and the grantee. It must be signed by the grantors, and it must describe the real estate collateral with specificity. These are explicit statutory requirements that are absent from the resident's asserted lien.
Can parties contract around the priority scheme in the statute for liens?
No, they cannot. There are such things as subordination agreements. So, for example, if you had two bank lenders offering a first and second mortgage, and the second mortgage lender, with everyone's consent, wanted to jump in front of the first mortgage lender, you could enter into a contract that allowed the one bank to do that, but you would need the superior lien holder's consent.
Is there any subordination agreement in these documents?
There is no subordination agreement in these documents. I will say that there are, in general, in the transaction documents. If you talk about the resident agreements, there are six different versions of them. Some of them may contain language that suggests that the resident interests are subordinated to the bank, but as the court well knows, those subordination provisions have not been enforced in prior published opinions. But we're not relying on those subordination opinions because you don't have to subordinate a lien that's A, non-existent, and B, already behind your lien in priority.
Counsel, yesterday the court received a letter from you with attachments. And on a quick review, it seemed that there was no legal argument that you made regarding the import of this information. Because I saw no legal argument regarding import, I took these documents to be a status update for our information only. Am I correct?
Yes, you are correct. There is no legal import. We had cited those cases in our petition for review. The court agreed to take judicial notice of them. We had cited them in a footnote in our brief. And in preparing for the argument, I realized I had been updating the court on them, and I didn't inform the court of the published decision from earlier this summer. So I thought it was my duty of candor to let you know that both of those cases had been resolved, one with a published opinion, but it has no bearing on our arguments.
Thank you.
Counsel, can you address Episcopal Homes? The main argument that you make in terms of distinguishing it is, you know, the funds were segregated, I think, but feel free to expand on that if you want. I'm trying to make sense of why that's a meaningful line, because the logic of your argument strikes me, I'll ask the question. If you're right about that in terms of the statutory priority here, does that mean that Episcopal Homes was wrongly decided?
This court doesn't need to decide that. And I'm glad you asked about Episcopal Homes, because I have a chart of five ways that Episcopal Homes. They all, of course, relate to the issue that you raised, Justice Hagedorn, which is the existence of a segregated fee fund. But there are multiple separate legal distinctions that arise from that factual distinction. The first of all is the legal question that was addressed by the case. The court in Episcopal Homes was asked, do the rights of the residents in a segregated entrance fee fund, should those rights be subordinated to the bank's liens? There was no real estate at issue in that case. There was no Chapter 128 receivership in that case. There was no sale of assets free and clear of liens in that case. The question here is whether the residents' claims to the proceeds of a sale of real estate, and only real estate, can prime a bank's mortgage lien. Two different factual scenarios, two different legal questions, and two different outcomes. So this court need not say a word about Episcopal Homes. Second, the procedural posture of the case is different. Episcopal Homes was a declaratory judgment action by a bank to subordinate a resident claim, resident claims, to an entrance fee fund. This is a declaratory judgment by a Chapter 128 receiver to establish as a matter of law the priority of a bank mortgage lien on real estate property proceeds. In fact, in Episcopal Homes, there was, as referenced in a footnote, a separate real estate foreclosure action brought by the bank against the retirement facility in that case. This issue might have, could have arisen in that case, but none of that is in the record, and we don't know. So the answer that Episcopal Homes reached just isn't the answer here because of the, because again of that legal implication of the factual distinction. The circuit court found a whole bunch of reasons to distinguish Episcopal Homes, and we think those were all valid. Judge Paulson looked carefully at the way the resident agreements described the entrance fees and the way those agreements described how funds would be deducted from those fees, and he concluded that the terms in the Episcopal Homes resident agreements had many features that made them look like security deposits.
But the hard part with that, if you actually look, you know, if you look at the administrative code definition of security deposit, it doesn't doesn't say they need to be segregated. It doesn't say that. So,
no.
That's why I'm just trying to zero in on sort of the obviously, all cases are different. There's different facts. Is the key issue that it's not a receivership action, not a real estate sales action, or is it? I'm just trying to get it. The segregation itself, doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Yeah. Well, maybe this will help. The lien that the Bank of New York Mellon as trustee holds on the Atrium property excludes capital E, capital F entrance fees that are held in escrow for the benefit of residents. If there had been such a fund, the residents would have a very strong argument that the bank's lien doesn't extend to those escrowed funds, just like the residents in Episcopal Homes had that argument. Here, we have a segregated pot of proceeds, probably decreasing in value as we speak due to inflation and no interest payments being made. But that pool of funds was entirely generated by the sale of a real property asset. And there is no additional money in this receivership estate to even cover the deficiency in the trustee's lien, much less to pay inferior claims or unsecured claims.
Counsel, I think there were more things listed than bricks and mortar, at least what I've read.
There was.
There's a lot of personal property that went along with this sale, and it was sold as a going concern.
Right.
I have a little question about the going concern. Are the people who paid entrance fees and have been living there, are they on the street because of this foreclosure on the bank's lien?
No, they're not.
Okay.
You're right, Justice Robinsack, about the description of the collateral being sold. It does carve out cash to the extent there was any. It carves out a lot of real property, a lot of personal property.
Right, right.
But if you look at, and we attach this to our appendix, if you look at the sale closing document, the receiver's report of sale, the real estate transfer return,
mm-hmm.
you'll see that a real estate transfer tax was paid on the full sale value of the property, which tells us conclusively that all of the value was allocated to real estate. So the buyer didn't pay anything for non-real property assets.
Okay. All right. But the buyer of this property is now operating.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
And that's why it was sold as a going concern, and that's why the residents are still staying there, because there isn't any reason to undo their occupancy rights that they got by virtue of the earlier payments. Is that correct?
That's right. There's nothing legally that required them to vacate. Now, to be clear, the buyer purchased the property from the receivership free and clear of all liens and encumbrances. Once the title passed to that buyer, the buyer had the ability to renegotiate resident agreements, to, you know, do whatever it wanted with the property. But Mr. Polsky and the buyer very specifically met with the residents of the facility prior to closing the sale, prior to even signing the asset purchase agreement, and agreed and assured the residents that they would not be required to move and that the new owner would hold their monthly residency fees, their monthly amounts, steady for a year. So if residents left, and I cannot say whether any did or did not, it was not by operation of law or having anything to do with the legal implications of the receivership or the mortgage treatment.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. I think we have covered Episcopal Homes. So I'll jump really briefly to the second ground, which is actually possibly a first, because as you know, we have an argument, a good argument, I think, that the order appealed from in this case was, which was the sale confirmation order, was not the order establishing the priority of the lien. The lien priority had been established a couple of years earlier when Judge Paulson issued his long decision and order establishing the lien priority. That order was final for purposes of appeal with respect to the residents because the only issue there was the validity of their lien, the nature of their claim, which the court conclusively determined to be unsecured, and the validity and primacy of the bank mortgage. With that decision decided, I'm sorry, I see my light is on. May I finish?
Finish your sentence.
Yeah. With that issue resolved, Mr. Polsky explicitly explained to the court and the parties and everyone involved in the transaction, including potential buyers, we are going to proceed with marketing and selling this property in reliance on the conclusive court determination on lien priority. And everyone proceeded from that point forward, after the appeal deadline for that order had passed, on the assumption that that was a final order. And so to have this issue raised through kind of an irregular insertion of a new order into the record after the first appeal had even been filed, and to allow that, this is a final judgment, capital language term to trump all of that other indicia of the intent of finality on the lien priority opinion, goes against the whole purpose of the finality doctrine, which is to avoid piecemeal litigation. So with that, my time is up. If you have no more questions, Justices, I will cede the rest of my time to...
You'll have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
I'll have 5 minutes. Thank you.
Chief Justice Ziegler, and may it please the court. My name is Joseph Peltz. I'm an attorney at Beckchate Bamberger and Polsky, and I represent Michael Polsky, the Chapter 128 court-appointed receiver for Atrium of Racine, Inc. I will be addressing the issue raised by the residents in their response brief regarding the receiver's fiduciary obligations. The residents claim that the receiver breached his fiduciary duty to them as creditors of the receivership estate by allegedly taking the side of one creditor over another on the priority issue. In the resident's supplemental letter brief on this issue that was filed with this court, the residents suggest that they do not have an issue with the fact that the receiver initially objected to the alleged secured status and priority of their claim. However, according to the residents, once the receiver raised this objection, the receiver needed to get out of the way and let the creditors litigate the priority issue. The following is a quote from the resident's supplemental letter brief filed with this court. Quote, if the receiver wanted the court to determine priority, he merely needed to tell the parties, I'm going to ask the court to determine which one of your claims has priority. It would then have been up to the parties to fight their own battles, end quote. The residents provide no legal authority for this argument, Your Honors. We believe that the Court of Appeals got it right with respect to this issue of the receiver's fiduciary obligations. In the Court of Appeals decision, the Court of Appeals stated, quote, the receiver has not breached his fiduciary duty by asking the court to make a decision as to priority, end quote. The Court of Appeals recognized that the receiver moved the circuit court on the issue of priority so that he could accomplish his duties under Chapter 128. And that's in footnote 12 of the Court of Appeals decision. Your Honors, the resident's fiduciary duty argument should be rejected for the following three reasons. First, the receiver was specifically charged with investigating and objecting to claims asserted against the receivership estate. Second, the receiver does not have a fiduciary duty to avoid taking any adverse position to the claim of a single creditor of the receivership estate. And finally, the residents are not alleging that they or anyone else suffered any damages as a result of the receiver's alleged breach of fiduciary duty. So with respect to my first argument, the resident's fiduciary duty argument should be rejected because the receiver was specifically charged with both investigating and objecting to claims asserted against the receivership estate. The residents argue that the receiver, quote unquote, took sides. That is simply not the case. What the receiver did here was he investigated the priority of the claims against the receivership estate. He then presented to the circuit court with his legal analysis as to the validity and priority of those claims, and he requested a determination by the circuit court. Your Honor, these actions are consistent with what is required under Chapter 128, specifically 128.15 and 128.17. Pursuant to these statutes, the receiver is required to distribute the proceeds collected from the sale of the debtor's assets in accordance with the priorities established by Chapter 128, specifically 128.15 sub 1 sub b. This statute states that the receiver may file a written objection to any claim, and it states that the objection should specify, quote, the grounds of the objection, end quote. This statute goes on to provide a process for these objections. It contemplates depositions, a hearing, and a ruling by the trial court on the objection. This statute allows the receiver to investigate and confirm the priority of claimed interests in the assets of the receivership estate. After that's done, then the receiver seeks an order from the circuit court confirming the priority of the claims and authorizing the disbursement of sale proceeds to creditors with allowed claims in the order of priority. In this specific case, the receiver investigated the priority of the claims asserted against the receivership estate by both the residents and the bondholders. And the receiver made two independent determinations. The first, he determined that the residents held unsecured claims against the receivership estate. And second, the receiver determined that the bondholders held a properly perfected first position security interest in the debtor's assets. The receiver then filed a written objection to the resident's claim in the form of a motion for declaratory judgment. After the many briefs submitted by the parties in support of the receiver's objection and in opposition to the receiver's objection, the circuit court entered an order determining that the residents held unsecured claims against the receivership estate. Moving on to my second argument.
Is that April 23, 2018?
The decision?
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. Now moving to our second argument.
When the receiver made his determination on this first argument, did he make it in light of the statements that are in the mortgage and the other documents relating to the leasing of this property by the residents about preferred liens that the Court of Appeals got stuck on? Did he talk about that at all?
Yes, Your Honor. So what happened was the receiver filed a motion for declaratory judgment. That issue was briefed. At the same time, the residents filed a motion for summary judgment, arguing their specific issue, putting forth those same arguments with respect to the language in those various documents. That motion was briefed. The circuit court denied the motion for summary judgment, granted the receiver's motion for declaratory relief. So all of those issues were addressed at the circuit court at that time.
What was the receiver's reasoning behind those statements in the various documents? I mean, the Court of Appeals found them troublesome. I couldn't make a lot of sense out of them either, and I found them troublesome as well.
Yeah, Your Honor, I think at the end of the day, the receiver concluded that the bondholders had a first position, properly perfected mortgage on the property, and that regardless of what the language was in those documents, there was no, the residents did not have a lien, and they certainly did not have a lien that could prime the lien of the bondholders.
Yeah, well, you know, the Court of Appeals found it was a preferred lien under those various documents, and that's why I was wondering what the receiver did with that kind of an argument, but...
The receiver presented a very similar argument that has been presented by the bondholders, both at the Court of Appeals level and at the Supreme Court, Your Honor.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, as a follow-up on that, if you're prepared to answer this area as opposed to your colleague, the statute requires that in order for it to be a final order that would dispose of the entire matter in litigation as to one or more of the parties. Opposing counsel says the sale might have produced enough to pay the claims of both the residents and the bondholders, and therefore it did not fully dispose of the entire matter. What's your response, if you're prepared to respond to that area of inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know if there's anything specifically in the record that would demonstrate this, but at the time that the motion for declaratory...
If it's not in the record, I pause. Okay.
Sure, Your Honor.
Maybe you're not able
Was the
to...
sale court approved?
At the time that the motion for declaratory... I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood. The sale was court approved, but the motion for declaratory judgment was filed previously.
Right. So the sale... Is the approval of the sale by the court in the record? Really, I think Justice Braley is concerned about getting something outside of the record.
Yes, right. Yes, Your Honor. Obviously, the approval of the sale is in the record, and obviously there were not enough funds to satisfy the bondholder's mortgage lien.
Yeah, but they would. Your opposing counsel says they wouldn't have known that, you know. I don't think in April, when you're asserting that's the final order that disposes the entire matter in litigation as to one or more parties.
Your Honor, I believe it was well known at the time that there was not going to be enough funds to satisfy the secured creditor's lien. I believe that there's most likely support for that in the record, but I would have to look back at the record and submit a supplemental letter in order to identify that specific document in the record.
Okay, thank you.
I see that my time has concluded. Thank you.
Mr. Becker.
Good morning, Justices. Again, my name is John Becker, and with Attorney Devine, we represent the residents. Now, before doing anything else, what I intend to do is lay out for you what our arguments are going to be, kind of like an opening statement, so you know what issues Mr. Devine's going to handle and which issues I'm going to handle. So first, I intend to lay out the issues, summarize the arguments and facts in about one paragraph, explain how I'm going to outline our argument and why, and then I'll go through my arguments. Now, again, the main issue in this case is that the bondholders, by the terms of the documents, agree that the residents would be reimbursed their entrance fees before receiving any funds from the foreclosure. The second issue is the jurisdictional issue. The third is the conflict of interest issue. Mr. Devine will discuss the M&I case and its interrelationship with the documents, and he'll also follow up on the jurisdictional issue. Now, the jurisdictional issue and the conflict of interest issue, I believe, are pretty well covered in the brief, so I'm not going to spend as much time on it, but I want to address those first so I don't run out of time, and then hopefully have plenty of time for the main issue. Again, in a nutshell, the facts are that the Atrium issued bonds with certain provisions. The purchasers of those bonds bought those bonds subject to those conditions, and in those documents, the bondholders agreed that in the event of a foreclosure, bankruptcy, receivership, the residents would receive their entrance fees before the bondholders received any proceeds. Now, again, the first issue being jurisdiction, the starting point and the primary source of law is the statute, and it couldn't be much clearer. A final judgment or order is one that disposes of the entire matter in litigation as to one or more of the parties, whether rendered in an action or special proceeding. They don't say how that statute was complied with. Matter of fact, she said, they assumed there was an assumption that the first order in 2018 was a final order. We know what it means to assume something, and that's what they did here. They assumed something that was not, in fact, true.
Well, was the argument in that order that your clients had priority over any other lien?
I'm sorry?
In April, when the court decided this,
yes,
I understood the issues to be basically, tell us what the lineup is as to who gets the money first.
Correct.
Okay. And the court issued the order saying, here's the lineup of who gets the money first.
Yes.
And are you saying that was not final as to what the lineup was?
Of course it was. I mean, as far as that, it was not a final order in respect to appellate jurisdiction. Any motion you bring, you can have a motion in limine to exclude an expert. The judge may rule on it. He considers that a final order with respect to that issue.
But it's at that time, your clients knew they were not above the lien holder.
We knew that was the judge's decision. Again, it's just like if a judge excludes an expert witness, that's final with respect to that issue. It's not a final respect to the entire proceedings. It doesn't dismiss the case with respect to all the parties.
Right, right.
Right.
But it's important.
Of course it is.
If it's not sold for enough to pay everyone off, your clients knew they were maybe going to be without anything.
Based on the trial court's decision.
Talk to me about the agreement your clients had with, I think, Atrium, right?
With the Atrium?
Right. You said your clients had an agreement that they were going to get their money back if the place was going into foreclosure, bankruptcy, or something like that, right?
That's what the documents say, yes.
So what is your best case for that taking priority over a secured lien? Doesn't that mean your claims against them for, I mean, maybe the contract was improper contract under the law because you can't make those promises. I don't know. I don't know how you get by that because the lien holder is not waiving their right to have a lien that's above yours. The court said their lien was above yours, and I see the argument being they say, well, we were promised that once, and so we want our money back, right?
I apologize, but I'm not quite following.
Okay. I may be unclear. How do your clients think they get the money?
Based upon these documents, when the bondholders purchase these bonds, the documents, they, by purchasing these bonds, accept the conditions and the terms of these documents. These documents give, you know, the preferred liens or permitted liens, they give the entrance fees priority.
And were those liens ever recorded, or was there some sort of other?
No.
interest? No. I mean, how would someone else know that they're taking this property subject to those liens being given priority?
When you say, how does somebody know, who are you talking
someone
about?
Someone subsequent. How would someone with a secured interest know that they really don't have a secured?
Well, because they purchased these documents. They purchased these bonds under the conditions of these documents. These documents say that we're going to pay the entrance fees first. They agree that there are claims that can come ahead of a first mortgage. Some are statutory, and they even say they can agree to that. I think they cite Justice Rogensack in one opinion saying the secured property, or the secured creditor, absent the secured party's consent. They have given their consent with these documents. Otherwise, these clauses mean nothing.
So if these documents don't make your clients secured creditors, what do they do for your client?
It might be a distinction without a difference. It does not give them a lien. Just like, you know, I use the example of Holy Name Church. I went to Holy Name and was born in the 50s. They built a new school back then, you know. If a person, in my example, I say, geez, you know, they've got this chandelier they bought, and they go to a bank for a loan. They say, I would like a loan, but I want you to agree that chandelier goes back to Holy Name if there's a foreclosure. And the bank agrees to it. Well, they can't change their mind. They can't withdraw their consent 10, 15, 20 years later. They have to honor that agreement. It doesn't give Holy Name a lien on the property, but it does give them a priority right or a priority claim. Again, it may be a matter of semantics. It doesn't give them a lien in terms of the right to foreclose, but it gives them a prior claim to the proceeds. And that's what the documents say. That's what the Court of Appeals held.
When you say the documents, the documents you're talking about are the project contract and the other ones that were put together in about 2002, is that what you're talking about? Way back
yes,
then?
Yes, the project contract, the prospectus, and the mortgage.
They're okay, all those issued, three.
Yes, they're okay. All issued at the same time. And they even acknowledge that at page 19 of their brief, they say that their lien is governed by the terms of the transaction documents that created it. They use the word documents plural. And then they spend 10 pages telling the Court of Appeal or saying the Court of Appeals should not have considered these other documents. Yet in their own brief, they say those documents created their lien.
Who created the documents? Do you know?
I do not.
Well, did the bank create them or did the residents have a committee to create them?
Oh, the residents had no input as far as I know.
Okay.
Counsel, you can see that your clients have no security interest in the real property, right?
Not in the real estate.
Okay, and you have also conceded that your clients do not have a lien of any sort on the property.
On the real estate.
Okay, and you also concede that the only pot of money available as a result of the receivership is the proceeds of the real estate.
Yes.
Do you also concede that the proceeds from the sale of the real estate are insufficient to satisfy the bank's mortgage?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm not following you because I've never seen an unsecured creditor take priority over the secured creditor. There isn't any case law out there that says that allows that result to happen. So as sympathetic as your client's claims are, given the amount of money that they all put forward as entrance fees, I just don't see how they can jump ahead of a first priority bank mortgage.
And again, like I say, maybe a matter of semantics, but they cite in their brief, they say the secured party's perfected security interest in each asset is protected. And it is only the excess that is above that value that is subject to administration, absent a secured party's consent. You can't give consent and then withdraw it when it's convenient, which is what they're doing here. They gave consent when they purchased these bonds. Those terms are in these documents. If not, there's 150 pages of documents that mean nothing.
Is your argument in part that the documents create what you refer to as a permissive lien? Is that the what you're holding on to?
That's the term that they've used, permissive lien, yes.
And then the question is, can there be a permissive lien without fulfilling the normal requirements of a lien?
Of course, because in a case like this, I don't think anybody would expect the tenants or the atrium to file a lien each and every time a tenant moved in and out. That's why they have these types of clauses. They're not going to file a lien, then the tenant moves out, we file a satisfaction of lien, now we have to file another lien for the new tenant. These documents make it very clear why they're doing what they're doing. They're protecting the entrance fees of the residents.
So really your argument's like the chandelier, right?
Yeah, that's an analogy.
That the secured lien holders knew that that lien was subordinate to making sure the chandelier went back.
Yes. Yes. So I've been...
Is there any subordination agreement in the record? Any at all? I didn't find any.
The only subordination agreement I know, I believe one of the six entrance fee agreements they had a subordination agreement, but again, under M&I Homes, and Tom will address that more, it's not valid.
So as I'm reading the contract documents, the best reading I can give it is that the bank consented to the possibility that other liens could exist. But I don't see anything in the contract documents suggesting that any of those permitted liens could take priority over the first priority lien established by the mortgage. So a permission to allow liens to exist, which I think you'd concede the bank under these circumstances of a mortgage would have to permit, just the fact that the bank would allow those to possibly exist does not mean that they take priority.
If you say, the clause was, these liens may exist. Well, if you say may or may not, the clause means nothing. It means that if these liens are in existence, they're going to take priority. Otherwise, the clause, again, it means nothing.
But again, you're not arguing that any of your clients have a lien on the property, on the real estate.
Not on the real estate, but they have the right to get paid from the proceeds before the bondholders do. That's what the bondholders agreed to. Now, I see I'm running out of time, so I just want to just touch real quickly on the conflict of interest issue. And we're not trying to give Mr. Polsky a hard time, but the fact is there's two creditors who have attorneys who are representing them, and he's putting his thumb on the scale, favoring one over the other.
Counsel, in these receivership proceedings, I used to be involved in them as an advocate. The receiver always takes legal positions. Are you suggesting that the receiver can never take a legal position that might happen to align with one party or the other? Because that happens all the time.
I don't think they should. A receiver doesn't have to be an attorney. You could, let's say a farmer goes bankrupt or goes into receivership. You may hire a farmer who has expert in that area. He's not going to start making legal opinions or making legal recommendations to the court. It's like a guardian ad litem. Okay, a guardian ad litem might make a recommendation on a divorce regarding a child. May make a recommendation against one parent or another. But what he can't do is make a recommendation against the best interest of the child. And here you've got a receiver who is supposed to be representing or has a fiduciary duty to all of the creditors. He can object to invalid claims, but once the claims are valid, it's not his job to decide priority. That's the court's job. It does not give the receiver the right or the duty to determine priority.
But the receiver isn't determining priority. The receiver is making the argument to the court about priority, right?
Well, right. Okay. Exactly. And it really, there's no basis for it.
Well, what about the statute? How do you get around 706.11.1a, which says, of course, duly recorded, shall have priority over all liens upon the mortgage premises and buildings? How do you get around that? It seems relatively straightforward.
Well, they acknowledge that there are things that can come ahead of a first mortgage. The question becomes, what is it? And in this case, and again, we've talked about it, they can agree to it, and they did agree to it. and they agreed to it when they purchased these bonds. So there, even they acknowledge there are things that can come ahead of a first mortgage. The question is, what are they? And so you have to look at the documents. There's a whole list of permitted liens that all would come ahead of the first mortgage. But, you know, they're picking out one and saying it doesn't apply in this case. They don't say what these clauses mean, why they're in there, because if they're basically writing them out of the contract. I mean, if they don't mean that the residents get paid first, there's no reason to have those clauses in there. And I see my time is up, so I'll defer to Mr. Devine.
Okay, thank you.
Justices, I'm going to start with a concept which is, I think, one of the most important things to understand here. And that is that this interaction that we're talking about is investor. And the documents that we have here, prospectus, documents with respect to your mortgage, description of what is at issue, are investment documents. In 1995, this industry believed that these resident agreements and owner agreements were something that could be separately addressed. And then came the Episcopal Homes case. My firm was involved in that one. The bank felt it had the right to take everything. Once the owner and the residents became tenants, and the whole panoply of regulation that came to bear under tenant protection changed the way that you looked at these transactions. So in 1995, when you are working with a business that has the paradigm that we're talking about here, in 1996, you knew it was landlord-tenant. In 97, you knew it was landlord-tenant. In 98, you knew it was landlord-tenant. This is 2002. They knew it was landlord-tenant. The scrivener of these documents is Ziegler Investments. Highly capable, large firm, defining what the rights of the investors are going to be in the problem solving that is part of investment. Scrivener now is confronting in 2002 the reality that security deposits have priority.
But Episcopal Homes did not involve the proceeds from the sale of real estate.
It did
not. I don't see how it has any application in this case, because that's all we're dealing with
here. Yes, because in this case, the problem solving that was engaged in by the scrivener was to identify those costs and tell the investors those costs are preferred encumbrances and they will come before you. Your investment documents tell you that I've solved that conundrum of how to deal with the problem.
But you aren't suggesting, are you, that a prospectus can disturb a first mortgage lien?
Yes, because the investor is told what are my rights, and they are told they will have a mortgage on the property, but they are also told that security deposits are going to have the opportunity to, and in fact will be given, priority in the proceeds of what you
have. But those security deposits, they don't exist. They were used, as I understand from the record, as part of the operating funds of the institution, which is now in receivership, right? So all we're dealing with, that pot of money doesn't exist. The only pot of money we're dealing with is the proceeds from the sale of the real estate.
That's precisely why they drafted it this way. M&I set aside funds, but one of the standard operating procedures in these businesses was to take the funds and use them to deal with your business. What do you do under that circumstance? Now that you have a declaration that this is landlord-tenant, how do you conform in 2002 to the reality that security deposits are going to have priority? You do the problem solving in your investment papers. You do the addressing of the conditions in your investment papers. You tell the investors that these security deposits are going to have priority, and you understand that when you put your dollar down as an investment, that if push comes to shove and this thing takes a terrible turn, security deposits are going to be considered.
Has any court in the entire country ever ruled in the way that you are asking this court to rule, which is what the Court of Appeals decided, that unsecured interests can somehow jump over the priority of a mortgage lien?
When the problem solving that was used to anticipate this problem says that's what you're going to do, absolutely.
But is there a single case in this country where a court has ruled in accordance, other than our Court of Appeals, in accordance with what you're asking us to rule today?
Well, I understand the court's perspective, but the reality here is that problem solving within this industry can be we're gonna court the disaster of litigation between the residents and the bank. Or you can do problem solving as was done here, which is it's solved. This is the way it gets addressed. So no court would ever be involved specifically in the process because it's already solved.
So there isn't any case that supports your position?
I'm not aware of one, but I would be surprised that any such case would exist, given the clear language of what is supposed to take place here, that this is an investment, that you understand what your risks are, and that in taking those risks, you've accepted the paradigm that says entrance fees are going to be first.
So is your argument that Episcopal Homes was a little bit of a sea change in the law and changed the way business operated, that these
Absolutely.
Things all operated? Is that
Absolutely.
Kind of the premise of your...
Yes. Yeah.
And you're saying these were drafted with the idea that security deposits always trump, regardless of the statutory language?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Fine, go ahead.
When you're Scrivener in 2002, you understand that after Episcopal Homes, there is now a highly regulated industry, or not industry, but process that is now in play in this process. For me, as a Scrivener, the most telling issue in Episcopal Homes was when they took the document that said this is not a lease and said, yes, it is. When you are developing agreements and process, that's your worst nightmare. So Episcopal Homes informed everybody, and it forms the basis for what decision-making was done in this case. So that Ziegler was comfortable with providing investment advice in the prospectus and then drafting these other documents to provide that entrance fees are going to have this priority, and you know it.
Absent, if Episcopal Homes had never been decided, and the Court of Appeals, you know, explicitly says it's relying on that case, should you lose based upon the statutory language? I mean, would you agree with your opposing counsel's statutory argument but for Episcopal Homes?
Well, no, we'd be arguing Episcopal Homes. We'd be taking the position this is a landlord-tenant process. It is a regulated process, and Episcopal Homes would be the basis of what you were doing. But the disconnect here is there is no attack on Episcopal Homes. There's no suggestion that it was wrongly decided. There's no issue with respect to that being the status of the law. And what we have to realize here is that we are looking at transactions that are taking place within the context of that change. And why did they draft a document that said, well, if it's an escrow, it belongs to the resident? Because that's what Episcopal Homes said. You would never draft an investment document that didn't lay out what the potential risks were. And moreover, Scrivener here now has to contend with the fact that at some point in the future, there may be this contest that has to happen, and we're devising a way for that to be explained to the investor.
You said that if there was no Episcopal Homes, you'd be arguing that position. So I want you to put Episcopal Homes aside for just a minute. what's your argument that, a security deposit would, even a security deposit or something along those lines would trump a secured mortgage?
Because the relationship between these residents and the deposits that they make and the owner is that of landlord and tenant. And there are all these rules that apply with respect to the owner's obligation to repay the covenants. If you look at appellate page 48, there's covenants of the obligors. It's 3.1, and the exception says this mortgage constitutes a direct and valid lien on and security interest in the mortgage property, subject only to permitted encumbrances. They're not able to give you the whole measure because their promise in the investment is we will give you what we have, but not anything more. And then you go on and you look at what is a permitted encumbrance, and that's at page 59 of the documents. And at entrance number 10, it says entrance fees or similar funds deposited by or on behalf of the residents are permitted liens.
Counsel?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
You acknowledge that before taking occupancy of the unit, that each resident was required to pay a security deposit and an entrance fee. You say that in your brief on page 4.
Well, the security deposits were a separately accrued responsibility, but yes, then the entrance fees were also paid.
Yes. So now you're arguing that the funds are being disputed constitute something akin to another security deposit?
No. We're suggesting that entrance fees are permitted encumbrances under this document, and as a permitted encumbrance, it's something that the obligor can't convey. That's the issue. So with respect to the progress here, I think it's important for the court to understand that this happened within the context of the sea change that took place in Episcopal Homes.
I just want to follow up on Justice Bradley's question. I want to make sure I understood you right. Are you saying that, Episcopal Homes said these entrance fees are security deposits and sort of grounded it that way.
Right.
What I thought I heard you say in response to Justice Bradley's question was that entrance fees themselves are sort of a separate thing. It doesn't matter that whether they're considered security deposits or not, but they should be treated the same way as security deposits in Episcopal Homes were.
No, documents themselves allow a permitted encumbrance to be the entrance fees. The distinction between security deposit and not was important in M&I because there the obligations with respect to repaying these had to get established since the documents were drafted in a way that wouldn't have provided for that opportunity. Okay. So the court needed to obtain the authority to look at the transaction through a different focus and establish landlord-tenant. Chapter 134 of the Administrative Code, limits on what you can do with respect to your tenants, limits on how you can handle security deposits. 2002, we draft this document. And that's the law. So that's how it gets informed. And the decision-making in the drafting of this document is one intended to eliminate this sense of, well, it has to be specifically this, and it needs to be specifically that. And the hair-on-fire arguments that are being made here concerning the, the effect on the banking industry. No, it's the investment acumen and the problem solving that was done at the inception of this deal.
Counsel, when I asked, are you arguing that the entrance fees are really security deposits? And then I note, my question indicated earlier, that at the inception, residents are required to pay security deposits and entrance fees. But I also observe that in your brief, you say, entrance fees paid by residents are security deposits protected by Administrative Code 134.063.
Yep.
So are they security deposits or are they not security deposits?
That statement is true, because under M&I, Episcopal Homes, entrance fees become security deposits. That's the way the law defined it. In this agreement, they are talking about entrance fees being permitted encumbrance, and the idea, the distinction between what it references isn't important in understanding how this agreement handles that distinction. If I were here without Episcopal Homes, that would be the important argument to be made concerning, well, what's the nature of these? They're ill-defined. We don't know what we're going to do with them. Landlord-tenant, security deposits, and all the ramifications of what that provides. But we've already had that decision. So this document is drafted within that context. Thank you.
Ms. Stadler, as you're making your way up there, I'm over here. Can you, and you probably are going to do this, can you help me understand what your position is with regard to the landlord-tenant argument? I'm not sure you were able to touch upon that when you started. And I'm just noting that the Court of Appeals held that the residents in the atrium contracted as landlord-tenant and then went on to say their contracts were rental agreements within the meaning of the law. And, of course, I think that conclusion was made based on the Episcopal Homes case.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I absolutely can. The landlord-tenant discussion here, we can set aside the fact that this is a Wisconsin-specific debt cap regulation rule enacted under the authority of the legislature, which created debt cap to regulate landlords and tenants and other things. We don't have to discuss, although we could, how that regulation can trump not just a panoply of state statutes, but all of the municipal bond regulations, all of the IRS provisions that are cited in these documents regarding tax exemption. We don't have to really put those two things on both sides of a scale, because if you cut to the chase, let's cut to the end. Let's say, yep, they're security deposits. There's three different kinds of security deposits, there are four different kinds, and they made all of them. And the regulation says you should keep those segregated, and the atrium didn't. All of that is true, assuming the money isn't there. So the result of that, if this entity weren't in receivership, would be these residents would have a claim for a violation of the regulation. They might win that claim. They might get a judgment in the amount of their entrance fees. They'd get double that judgment because the ACCAP regulations give them two times damages. They'd still be holding an unsecured claim. They'd be holding a judgment, or a judgment lien even, that's inferior in priority to the mortgage.
Are you aware of any case in the country that has allowed the claims of unsecured creditors to trump the claims of secured creditors?
I'm not.
Are you aware of any cases in the country of contractions around the secured creditor's priority?
You mean parties contracting around? Yeah, sure.
That's what they're saying occurred here.
Yes.
That's the argument.
Sure. It happens all the time in the financial industry. A company needs more capital. The first bank says, I'm not comfortable extending any more credit. The second bank steps up and says, I'll take this risk, but I want to be on a par with the first lender. I want to take ahead of the first lender. And then the parties all sit down and they negotiate how much is the value of the collateral, what's the likelihood of the debtor being able to pay it back, and they make a business decision as to whether bank one, number one I mean, not bank one, wants to subordinate its debt to someone else. They do under some circumstances.
You know of
they
any law
hear.
That would have prevented the contracting that is argued by opposing counsel for this particular case in the project contract, the mortgage, and a prospectus?
Justice Rogensack, is your question whether the residents could have entered into a subordination agreement with the trustee?
No, the question is whether you know of any law that would have prohibited this kind of a, quote, contract, which is what we've been told it is, from going forward.
No, I mean, I think if the parties all sat down and said, because of the Court of Appeals ruling in Episcopal Homes or any other reason, we want to alter the legal priority of secured liens related to housing, retirement housing.
Okay.
We are going to require the execution of a subordination agreement. They could do that in connection with setting up a facility like this.
I don't consider the documents that have been referred to as a subordination agreement.
No, they're not. I mean,
why not?
The documents that make up this transaction are the project contract, the trust indenture, and the mortgage. Those are the transaction documents. We hear a lot about this. My light's on. Can I continue?
You can finish your answer.
This prospectus, which is actually called an official statement in municipal bond parlance.
Mm-hmm.
This is the official statement. It has a narrative that, and we've cited this in our brief, disclaims this is a summary description of the transaction documents. This is a disclosure of risks related to the indebtedness being taken on in the transaction documents. And then it attaches some of the transaction documents, and it attaches financial statements, and it attaches definitions from the transaction documents. But the transaction documents define the parameters of the indebtedness here. And the transaction documents don't have a subordination agreement in them. To the contrary, the transaction documents establish a first lien for a mortgage holder. The only way to get around that, because this is an indenture and there are bondholders, would be to get the permission of each bondholder. I don't even think the trustee has the authority under the indenture.
You're focusing on a different thing than opposing counsel.
Yeah.
Is in regard to the documents that are relevant, because they talk about this as being an investment. Well, I have a few investments, and I read the prospectus before I put my money down on an investment.
Right.
And you had the prospectus that you were saying you didn't list it as one of the transaction documents, but certainly as an investor, it's a transaction document.
Yeah, no, and I'm not certainly trying to – I mean, look, the contents of the prospectus are carefully – regulated. You can't just issue a municipal bond and put whatever you want in there. So the notion that when these documents were put together in 2002, the bond underwriter and the bond counsel and the counsel for the borrower and the counsel for the lender and the counsel for the housing authority, all of those people sat down and made these agreements. The argument is somehow they were aware but didn't put in the documents. In Wisconsin, because of Episcopal Homes, because of Judges Brown, Nettesheim, and Snyder in 1995, none of this really means what it says.
And I have to cut you off because it's been a little while after your red light and even the question after the red light, which we try not to do.
I apologize. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
for your time. I appreciate it.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your argument in this matter. The court is adjourned and will reconvene for the second case of the morning. All right, please be seated. Calling our second case of the morning, Robert Slumka versus General Heating and Air Conditioning. Could I? Morning. Morning. All right, the lineup is 25 minutes followed by 15, and 5 minutes in rebuttal, right? All right, please proceed.
Again, Your Honors, my name is Walter Stern. I represent Robert Slumka. This case is, to my knowledge, is the first case concerning an applicant or employee filing for a position. And Mr. Slumka did that, General Heating and Air Conditioning. And ultimately, the WERC and then all of the agencies and courts after that found they were without jurisdiction, that there was a federal preemption. Our position is that this court should reverse and remand because it is an unfair labor practice under 111.06 parent 1A, and also under the Act, the Right to Work Act, it talks about obtaining or continuing employment. Well, Mr. Slumka was.
Just so I'm clear on the facts. Didn't Mr. Slumka first file a charge with the NLRB, and didn't they rule in his favor?
Yes, they. Oh, I'm sorry.
I know it's. Isn't it funny? Sometimes
in any event, they ruled there was a violation.
Right.
But. Essentially, I'm not trying to be facetious, they were good boys and changed the ad, and therefore they're okay.
Well, so I agree that they didn't find a violation, but they basically said that they took his case and ruled on it.
Yes.
Okay, so if they took his case and ruled on it, why are we talking about preemption? Why are we not just talking about res judicata? It's all done.
Because the Right to Work Act and Section 7 of the Wagner Act are not the same. They're different laws, in our opinion.
Okay. All right.
So, counsel, I need you to explain to me how you get around United States Supreme Court case law that is really clear that an unfair labor practice is a matter for the NLRB. I'm citing Retail Clerks International Association. I'm citing Garmin. And that the only type of agreement that the state agency can adjudicate are actual negotiation and execution of the agreements described by sub 14B.
And
that's really the contract. And I hear you saying this is an unfair labor claim that you are disputing. I read the complaint. That's what the dispute is. And so why you want us to overturn or go against U.S. Supreme Court case law? Is that what you're asking?
I'm not asking that. In the Algoma case and in the other case you cited.
So which case are you citing now? You
Algoma.
Relied on?
Algoma is one case, and that's what they relied on.
That's what who relied on?
Yes.
What are you saying?
I'm looking at the Supreme Court decisions that the court referred to. One of them, the first one really was Algoma, and then Garmin. What the court said is that unless there is a direct conflict, then there is. The state does have many rights in labor relations. And the Taft-Hartley Act under 14B gives a particular power to the states to choose a unfair labor practice or to adopt a right-to-work act. Now, at the time, there was 12 different states. Now I think there's 24 states.
I don't think the dispute here is whether there could be a right-to-work act. There is one. And I don't think the dispute here is whether there could be a claim under the right-to-work act or not. The claim that's being made is that this particular type of claim is one for the NLRB. And again, I still haven't heard how you get around this language.
Well,
about conduct, arguably an unfair labor practice would be a matter for the NLRB under Garment. And
because,
that is retail clerks.
Because the state adopted a law that gave a person the right to work. And it is a strong public policy of the state. And the decisions you cited talk about the test being, is there a direct conflict? And we don't see a direct conflict at all.
Okay, so you want us to disregard
no.
Supreme Court case law, because that issue of whether it's a direct conflict has already been decided, even the case you cited. You cited the Sweeney versus Pence. Can you show me in Sweeney where it says you have a claim? I mean, that's the case you cite in your
but
brief,
I'm not
seeing that as not being preempted.
And I'm saying that the decisions you cite do not say that when you have a right to work act, that you cannot proceed to enforce a remedy. And the state even says no person may require as a condition for obtaining, which means securing employment. And what they did here was say, you have to join a union and 60 days to be employed. So therefore, he has 60 days of work, if at best. And I don't read the decisions that say that the NLRB, if we just had the Wagner Act, if we just had the National Labor Relations Act, I could see that very clearly, that the state can't pass an unfair labor practice. But here the state did. And the state gave employees a right. And when the courts referred to execution and enforcement of a labor contract, they didn't say, the court did not say, that it excluded applying for employment. Now, you're implying that it did, but they didn't say that.
Okay. I obviously read this quite differently than you in what they said, that the only thing that the states can adjudicate at this point are the contracts, the actual negotiation and execution of the agreements in Section 14B. It's the contract between a union and a private sector employer regarding union membership.
Then I ask the court, why did the statute under 111.04 parent 3A indicate no person may require as a condition of obtaining employment unless the word obtaining means nothing.
You're asking me why the legislature did that?
Well, I'm saying that kind of rhetorically because they provided a state unfair labor practice. They provided a state definition of obtaining or continuing employment. And the court cases you cite didn't hold based on the Right to Work Act that is another federal law comes into play. That's the Taft-Hartley Act, 14B. I did the best to answer your question.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, we'll proceed. I've kind of made my argument, but in looking at some of the cases that I've cited, most cases have dealt with unions who want to get money and impose assessments, or a union like the Court of Appeals case that wants the courts to disregard the Right to Work Act. So I think the justice is correct that there is no case. I wish I had one. Maybe we wouldn't be here today. But there is no case specifically saying, because it's a fairly new law. It's 2015 we passed the law. The first case was 2016 that dealt in federal court challenging the law. And then we have Sweeney, which was an Indiana statute similar to ours that dealt with the right to work in Indiana and some good language as to the purpose, none of those decisions specifically deal with whether or not you can have an unfair labor practice under a law that clearly, in our view, permits that.
Counsel, do you agree that the Employment Relations Commission says there's no allegation and no proof of any contract here that requires union membership as a condition of employment? Do you disagree with that?
Do I say that? I'm sorry, Judge.
The Employment Relations Commission in its decision work said that there's no allegation and no proof that there is a contract between General Heating and Air Conditioning in any union that requires union membership as a condition of employment.
We don't know that, Judge. And what I'm saying is that there was an ad in Indeed.com that said that as a condition of employment, within 60 days, an employee would have to join the union. Since we haven't had a hearing on the Right to Work Act, I infer, not assume, that the company would not have put that ad in there without a labor-managed agreement. The court is right. There is no agreement before you. Correct.
Did you have an opportunity at the hearing before work, though, to present evidence regarding the existence of agreement?
Not really, because the administrative law judge said that, in his view, he didn't have jurisdiction. That would be something, if you remanded it, I would definitely introduce that into evidence.
What was the hearing before work about then?
I'm sorry.
What was the hearing before work about? What happened at the hearing?
At the hearing, we took some evidence, and that was it.
What was the evidence about?
The evidence was about the fact that under the initial ad said that any employee must join the union within 60 days. That came out.
Could you have introduced evidence about the existence of an agreement at that time?
Probably I could, but I was told there wasn't jurisdiction, so I don't think there was a full hearing.
In your complaint, did you allege that there was an agreement or that there was negotiations?
No, to answer your question.
Do you think that is fatal to the complaint?
No, because the ad said that you had to be a member of the union. Employers can't violate the rule any more than labor unions. They're both bound to the right to work.
In the earlier questioning by Justice Dalit, she made reference to the test employed with regard to preemption for the NLRB.
Yeah.
And an exception to that jurisdiction is if there were actual negotiations or execution of an agreement. Since you've not alleged actual negotiations or execution of an agreement.
We're saying that, I understand what the court.
Sure.
We're saying that if that were the restrictions, that you have to have an agreement or absence of agreement, we've never denied in our briefs that that would not be, you know, if they were going to restrict it. But neither 14B, or our 14B gave a right for a right to work law, but nowhere does it say that that would only, it only be related to execution or enforcement. And that's our position. Because the court never held that the Right to Work Act could not create remedies. I guess that's our point. In expanding on that, in Garman, which I think is a good case to explain that under the individual situation, a state very well may adopt rules and regulations with respect to hire and employees, and that's exactly what the state of Wisconsin did in 2015. And I don't want to continue to harp on it, but why would they say obtaining employment? Obtaining means secured employment. And the WRC has lots of regulations on how to proceed on a complaint. How would this harm in any way or undermine the National Labor Relations Board or somehow directly, as Justice Frankfurter said, in Garman? How would this really harm them? I mean, this is a state law. It's a citizen of the state who followed that state law and who sought remedies under the state law. And I understand what's being said, but I don't see a direct conflict that's not recognized in Taft-Hartley 14B. In going further, in looking at the cases, as I said, there is no direct case, so I'm using the language of the statute and the interpretation of the statute. And I might say that you should take the plain meaning of the statute. No word is superfluous. And that word is significant in that it does say obtaining employment. It does say it's an unfair labor practice. And there is no Supreme Court case that says that in a right to work statute that you can't proceed under state law. None. I wish there was. I probably wouldn't have even proceeded with this case if there was an actual decision that said that. Thank you.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court, my name is Dan Kaplan. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Foley and Lardner, and we represent General Heating and Air Conditioning, which was the respondent at the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission hearing that heard this matter, and then that from which the subsequent appeals were brought. I'm going to address the facts as they arose to get here, and Attorney Kilpatrick will discuss in greater detail the preemption issues that Justice Dallet raised with respect to the NLRA as well as Wisconsin's statute, the Employment Peace Act. Sorry, I leaned back. First off, on July 24 of 2018, Mr. Slamka filed a WERC complaint in which he alleged an unfair labor practice by General Heating requiring union membership to be employed, and he claimed that that was in violation of Wisconsin's Employment Peace Act or the Right to Work Law. On August 6, 2 weeks later, Mr. Slamka filed a charge as Justice Rogensack pointed out, with the National Labor Relations Board, which alleged a violation of Section 8A3 of the National Labor Relations Act, and claimed that General Heating had discriminated against him by requiring some sort of union affiliation in order to be employed. As you can tell, the claims are nearly identical. On October 26, 2018, after the parties, General Heating and Air Conditioning and Mr. Slamka, had submitted initial position statements as well as evidence to the National Labor Relations Board and the investigator responsible for investigating the charge, the investigator and the regional director issued a decision which dismissed the 8A3 charge based on a lack of evidence sufficient to support a finding of violation of the National Labor Relations Act. That was a merits determination. At that process, each side had the opportunity to submit sworn affidavits as well as documentary evidence. Prior to November 9th of 2018, so about a week or two later, Mr. Slamka was required to appeal that determination by the regional director, and he did so. He appealed it directly to the general counsel, and the general counsel then took under advisement that question. At the same time, the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission, hearing examiner Peter Davis, held an evidentiary hearing. Yes, an evidentiary hearing on December 18th of 2018. With all due respect to Mr. Stern, this was an evidentiary hearing, and it was not shortened, and Mr. Stern and the complainant at that time, Mr. Slamka, had all the opportunity that they desired to present whatever evidence and documentation they believed necessary to support a finding of violation of Wisconsin's right to work law. The hearing transcript is located at 613 through 109. It is some 80 pages in length. There were 8 documents and exhibits introduced by Mr. Stern at the hearing, all of which were received and taken under consideration. And in response to your question, Justice Hagedorn, there was no agreement submitted as an exhibit which contained a union security clause. Nothing of any sort of that was submitted at all. There were 3 witnesses who testified, Mr. Slamka himself during the complainant's case in chief, and 2 additional witnesses who testified during the respondent's case in chief. The elicited testimony from Mr. Slamka appears on pages 22 through 46 of the transcript. And Mr. Stern had opportunities for cross-examination of both respondent witnesses as well. At the conclusion of Mr. Slamka's testimony, Mr. Stern was asked if he had any further evidence or witnesses to submit in his case in chief. At page 46 of the transcript, I quote, "No, and the documents have already been marked and admitted, so we would rest." It was at that point in time that the complainant, Mr. Slamka, had submitted all evidence, all information that he believed necessary to prove a violation of law.
So just so I'm completely clear, because what I heard Mr. Stern say not less than 10 minutes ago was that the hearing really didn't take place and that the hearing examiner stopped it for jurisdictional reasons. You're telling us that didn't happen?
Correct. The hearing was approximately 2 hours in length. There was no determination made at the hearing. The parties requested and forewent closing arguments in lieu of submitting briefing. And the parties agreed on the date by which briefing would be submitted. And that the briefing would be submitted, I think it was by January 14th. After the completion of the transcript was prepared and delivered to all parties for utilization. All briefing was filed by January 14, and on January 17, ironically, 3 days later, the general counsel for the National Labor Relations Board affirmed the decision by the regional director dismissing the charge, finding insufficient evidence to conclude that a violation of the National Labor Relations Act had occurred. On March 4th, so about a month and a half later, hearing examiner Davis issued his decision. After full consideration of the testimony elicited at this two-hour hearing, after full consideration of all exhibits submitted and received into evidence, and after full consideration of the briefing of the parties. In that decision, hearing examiner Davis concluded that the commission could not exercise jurisdiction over the matter because the matter contained issues that were properly and exclusively within the board's jurisdiction, the National Labor Relations Board.
I'm going to ask you two questions. Yeah, during the proceedings before the WERC, did Mr. Slamka ever make any allegations regarding a formal agreement between your client and a union?
No, there was none made. And in fact, if you look at the decision from hearing examiner Davis, he was pretty clear. And he mentions, and I'm looking for exactly where it was, page 63, so it's in the record at 763. He concludes with, there is no allegation and certainly no proof that there is a contract between General Heating and Air Conditioning and any union that requires union membership as a condition of employment. So to get to your specific question, that issue and question was specifically addressed by the hearing examiner.
Thank you.
Who had the burden of establishing WERC's jurisdiction? And my second question is, who had the burden of establishing federal preemption?
So under U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence, the complainant has the original burden to establish the WERC's jurisdiction for the matter. And at once a preemption argument is presented, it is up to the respondent to identify the preemption issue, and then it's actually back on the complainant to prove that the state actually has the right to exercise jurisdiction over the matter. So both burdens actually fall to the complainant in that circumstance, or if not a complainant, to the person who is alleging that the state has jurisdiction. With respect to the matter, after Mr. Davis's decision was issued on April 11, the commission, it was appealed, and on April 11, the commission issued a decision adopting the hearing examiner's decision. That's at record 8, 46, and 47. A petition for reconsideration was sought by Mr. Slamka. That petition was denied. That's found in the record at 9:20. Circuit court review was then sought, consistent with Chapter 227 procedures associated with administrative agency appeals. And that occurred during the period at the end of 2019. On January 9, 2020, the circuit court issued a decision at R19, which affirmed the commission's determination. That decision was then again appealed as a matter of right to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. That's found at record 20. On March 11, 2021, the Court of Appeals issued a slip opinion, which also found a lack of jurisdiction. In that slip opinion, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals specifically stated at paragraph 7, it is well-settled case law establishes that the type of claim Slamka asserts in this case has been preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. When they made that pronouncement, they were citing the Garmin decision from the United States Supreme Court. Thereafter, Mr. Slamka petitioned this court for review. This court granted review, and we had subsequent briefing on the matter. As I mentioned at the outset, Mr. Kilpatrick, Attorney Kilpatrick, will address the more specific nuances of preemption, but I wanted to bring to this Court's attention a prior decision of this Court, which in my mind is on all fours with the issues in this case. And that's Arena versus Lincoln Lutheran of Racine, which is found at 149 West 2nd 35, 437 Northwest 2nd 538, 1989. In that case, there was a nurse who was working for Lincoln Lutheran, Nurse Arena, and she had been working with her colleagues relative to complaints associated with working conditions. That kind of conduct would normally be wholly protected by the National Labor Relations Act, either under Section 7 or Section 8. But in that case, the nurse, Ms. Arena, was in fact a supervisor. And so as a supervisor, the National Labor Relations Act does not protect that individual from discrimination based on union support or otherwise. Notwithstanding that fact, so that case actually has far greater bases to make an argument for a lack of preemption than this case. But notwithstanding that, this court noted there, that the gravamen of the complaint was a termination for essentially concerted protected activity. As that was the gravamen of the complaint, it was recognized that the National Labor Relations Act is the sole act that can oversee those kinds of complaints, and the board, the exclusive jurisdiction before which such complaints can be determined. And with that, unless there's any questions, I'm going to turn the addition of my time over to Attorney Kilpatrick to address a lot of the preemption issues, as well as Wisconsin's right to work law and how they interact. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chief Justice and Justices. May it please the Court, Stephen Kilpatrick representing the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission. This is a straightforward federal preemption case, and so I presume that we are here because of Mr. Slamka's claims that if this Court affirms, the Right to Work Act will be rendered meaningless and feckless for Wisconsin workers. Not true. And I'll give you three quick reasons why. First, a decision from this Court affirming the Commission's decision will do nothing more than confirm again that Congress has preempted from the states the field of labor relations. There is nothing unusual about that. Of the two types of field preemption in labor relations, machinist preemption, which is not relevant here, and Garmin preemption based on U.S. Supreme Court cases, it is Garmin preemption that controls the outcome. This is a Supreme Court decision from 1959 that this Court in Arena, for example, has already followed before. Second reason why you should not believe Mr. Slamka's sky is falling claims, only because of the Wisconsin Right to Work Act was Mr. Slamka able to file a charge with the National Labor Relations Board and obtain jurisdiction, alleging violations of his right to be free from employer interference with the exercise of his rights protected by Section 7 of the NLRA, by stating that union membership was a condition of employment in a job advertisement. Those rights, I note, he enjoys under both the NLRA and the Wisconsin Right to Work Law, 111.04 sub 2 and sub 3 sub A 2. That's the Employment Peace Act as amended by the Right to Work Act.
So just make sure I understand what you're saying. The state law and federal law, if an employer wrongly or falsely says you must join a union in order to work here, center application here, that is actionable, but that needs to go before the federal, before the NLRB. And it's only in the event that there actually is such an agreement
right.
where that would be proper for work.
That's correct, Justice Hagedorn. And that gets to my third point, which is only because of Wisconsin's right to work law did Mr. Slamka obtain a hearing before the commission, my client, to submit evidence of a union security agreement between the sheet metal workers and General Heating, which would be likely an unfair labor practice under the right to work law. Again, 111.061E. But he failed to do that. And I do want to mention, if you look at page 21 of the transcript of this evidentiary hearing, that is under the record R6-33, Examiner Davis says, I'll also say, as Mr. Slamka knows, not that long ago, I issued a decision, and that decision is not in the record, but that's beside the point, indicating that all matters are preempted except for the question of whether a union and an employer reached agreement on a contract that had union security language in it. That's, again, page 21 of the transcript. So that's the beginning of the evidentiary hearing. As Mr. Kaplan pointed out, Mr. Slamka had every opportunity to introduce that type of evidence, and at the end of the hearing, there was no evidence to that effect. So while it is true that the commission had to decline jurisdiction over his complaint, alleging a violation of his rights to be free from employer interference with the exercise of his right that union membership be a condition of employment, as alleged in the job advertisement, there is nothing surprising or unusual about federal preemption to that state law. Again, federal preemption, the basis is the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution. And that's what Mr. Slamka's complaint seems to be about, is the Federal Supremacy Clause. As this court has recognized in Town of Delafield, state law that conflicts with federal law is without effect, it is preempted. Federal preemption occurs when federal legislation occupies the field. Here, that field is labor relations. That was recognized by this court in 1960 in Local 248 United Auto. That is cited by us in our brief, I believe. It's at 11 Wis. 2nd, 277. So again, the National Labor Relations Act is, as amended by the Taft-Hartley Act, is the federal law that preempts most state labor relations law. Section 7, Section 8 of the NLRA are very similar to Sections 5 and 6 of the Employment Peace Act as amended by the Right to Work Act. What is important here is that Section 14B of the NLRA provides that nothing in this act shall be construed as authorizing the execution or application of agreements requiring membership in a labor organization as a condition of employment in any state in which the execution and application is prohibited by state law. That's Section 14B of the NLRA. And that is what Wisconsin did in 2015 by passing the Right to Work Act. It decided that in this state, we are going to prohibit agreements requiring membership in a labor organization as a condition of employment. And that opened up the ability for Mr. Slamka to have a hearing before the state, the Employment Relations Commission. That commission, state commission, has jurisdiction over such union security agreements. And even though there wasn't even an allegation in his complaint, Mr. Slamka's complaint, I believe in an abundance of caution, the hearing examiner allowed Mr. Slamka the ability to prove that there was such an agreement. And again, at the end of the hearing, there was no such proof. And for that reason, the allegations, the lack of evidence, required the commission to decline jurisdiction because the allegations in the complaint were arguably violations of the National Labor Relations Act, Section 7 and 8. And this court has said before, the state must yield to the National Labor Relations Board for determination of the merits of those claims. And here, in fact, as you heard before, that's exactly what happened. The merits of his claim to the NLRB, which significantly mirrored his claim to the commission, was decided on the merits. And so not only could there have been federal jurisdiction here, there was federal jurisdiction here. And the commission properly declined to exercise jurisdiction over Mr. Slamka's complaint. And I take this opportunity just to remind the court that we are here on a Chapter 227 petition for judicial review. It's an agency decision. Under Chapter 227 standards, the burden is on the petitioner to show that the agency's action was unlawful, an erroneous interpretation of the statute, and I submit that Mr. Slamka has wholly failed to do that. He has wholly failed to prove that the commission was wrong in declining jurisdiction over this case. So again, I just want to stress that, you know, why was there a hearing before the WERC? The reason was because federal law specifically carves out an exception for state jurisdiction in labor relations, and that is for union security agreements. So if you want to complain and litigate about the execution application of union security agreements, Section 14B allows states to do that. Many states across the country have done that. In 2015, Wisconsin did that, and that is the reason for the hearing before the WERC. And that was explicitly explained by the hearing examiner, again, on page 21. So again, Mr. Slamka had the opportunity. He provided no evidence that any union security agreement existed between General Heating and sheet metal workers. And for that reason, the commission properly declined jurisdiction. That concludes my remarks. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Stern, before you start, I think at best we have a misunderstanding, and at worst you maybe were not as forthcoming as you could have been in your initial statement. At least for me, I heard you say that there was not really a hearing in front of the WERC, and that the ALJ there stopped because that there were jurisdictional problems. But Mr. Kaplan came up and went through everything that happened in that hearing. I think he said it was over a two-hour hearing, and then he talked about how it took a while for the decision to come out, and it wasn't until the ultimate decision came out that the ALJ ruled ultimately that there was not jurisdiction. So can you
clear
that up for me?
I'd be glad to. What I said is that there was a decision, there wasn't jurisdiction. And the WERC is saying that it's a nullity. We did have a hearing, and he said no jurisdiction. Therefore, he didn't consider the evidence. Okay.
You did have a hearing, correct?
Yes, we had a hearing.
And at that hearing, you had the opportunity to allege that there was a formal agreement between General Heating and a union, correct?
Yes.
At that hearing, you also had the opportunity to present evidence that such an agreement existed. Is that correct?
Yes, but it also, under the Right to Work Act, says no person, including a company, may make, as a condition or in obtaining employment, the joining of a union. And that's what General Heating did.
I understand that, but how could
an ALJ ever find in your favor if you didn't even present the evidence that they would need in order to make those findings?
We did present evidence that the general based its decision in part on the ad that said you have to join a union in 60 days. That's what was proved.
At page 21 of the hearing,
yes.
See where it looks like the examiner said, I issued a decision indicating that all matters are preempted.
Yes.
And then carved out the question of whether there was an agreement between the union and the employer here, General
right.
Heating. And so what was reserved for you to have a hearing on was whether that agreement existed, and you had nothing to present on that, right?
That was not my understanding at all. What my understanding was is the judge or the administrative law judge was saying, well, you know, I don't have jurisdiction. That's what the judge said.
Well, I think what you wanted...
That's what he told me.
What you wanted from the examiner was for the examiner to basically hear your complaint about the ad and how the ad required
yes.
union membership.
Yes.
And what the examiner said to you was basically everything is preempted except for the union employer agreement. That was the examiner's interpretation. So as I understand your answer to Justice Kurofsky, you really were preempted from presenting what you wanted the argument
no.
to be.
No.
You were relegated to presentation of the agreement between the union and the employer before this examiner.
We were, if the company said, you've got to join a union within 60 days.
That's what you wanted to argue, but
yes.
the examiner said no.
Well, he didn't say no. He asked a question. It was a rhetorical question. Why would he let a hearing go on? This is where I think it's kind of disingenuous on the part of the WERC. On one hand, they're saying a preemption. On the other hand, the statute says no person, and that therefore my duty was to show that a person, a company, an employer, made as a condition of employment joining a union within 60 days. That was proved. That was proved at the hearing. So if you're saying that you're requiring an agreement?
I'm not saying that. I'm just reading what the examiner said
yeah.
before you really
yeah.
presented anything. And it was, we'll hear you on the agreement between the union and the employer, but we're not going to hear you on anything else because that's preempted by federal law. So I think that's how I read this, but I could be wrong.
I think that, like I say, the respondents have not dealt with the fact that there is an unfair labor practice. And is that unconstitutional? Is that void because it's preempted? And I definitely don't see that the Urbina case at all. It didn't involve the right to work. And it was dicta at best. And I just don't understand that the wording of the statute, no person may require as a condition of employment, means you have to prove a labor management agreement. And I guess it's just a disagreement in what the law is, and what the law is with the Taft-Hartley Act, 14B. I think 14B created a law that said neither a union nor a company may violate the act. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. The court is adjourned. We will reconvene at 1:30 for the third oral argument of the day.